Warning, do not listen to this podcast if hearing about freedom and liberty is not legal for you in your community. And if so, you should immediately move to a hipper community.
Welcome to the Freedom Fiends Podcast, a weekly web lab where Michael W. Dean and Nima Vedati cover the punk rockinist, hip-hopinist current events, as well as timeless universal truths about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, because there's no such thing as half-free. The Freedom Fiends Podcast, available from freedomfiends.com. That's freedomfiends.com.
Rolling. Freedom Fiends.
Freedom. Yeah.
Freedom. Hey.
What's up?
Freedom Fiends is proudly syndicated now by the Liberty Radio Network at LRN.FM.
LRN fools represent.
I feel like I need to have a more radio-like voice now. I don't really, though.
Maybe we need we should make our own jingle for Freedom Fiends on LRN.
Ooh. I could do that with DJ. Because she and I can sing. You can't sing. She and I could do the Liberty Radio Network, and then you could rap the FM.
Okay. Yeah, we could do that.
Yeah. So, yeah, we are syndicated now by them. That's a site that's run by Ian Freeman from Free Talk Live, who's out of jail and back spreading the seditious word of liberty.
Yeah. It's dangerous to be right when the government is wrong.
How can the government be right when it feels so wrong? I'm going to jump right in here.
Okay, go for it.
I read something today. It's a local thing, Wyoming state thing. It kind of appalled me. I didn't know this, but did you know that the head of the Wyoming Meth Project, the chairman of the Wyoming Meth Project, is the publisher of the Commie Star Tribune?
No, I didn't know that, but that doesn't surprise me at all. The media media moguls love stuff like that. Anything to scare the public. That's what they feed off of, is crazy cat spots and scaring people. And meth was a bogeyman. And didn't they get Darren Aronofsky to do those scary, scary meth ads in Montana?
Yeah, well,
Wyoming?
he did the first few.
Okay.
And they totally looked like Requiem for a Dream.
Right, right.
And Darren, by the way, is interviewed in my movie, Hubert Selby Jr., It'll Be Better Tomorrow.
Which you should check out.
Check that
out. It's good.
CubbyMovie.com. But yeah, he did the first five or something, and then they just got some low-budget non-union guy who copied his look on the rest of them.
That's right.
But even the billboards look like that look, sort of. But it's a government-funded thing where they put these scary billboards with, like, teenage prostitutes with sores all over their bodies and missing teeth, and I have to see them when I drive down the street, even though I don't utilize methamphetamine or teenage prostitutes, but I still have to look at this shit. You know, the head of the local statist paper being the chairman of that, it seems like a conflict of interest to me. It seems like the head of the candy company running the diabetes hospital or something.
How so?
Here you go. There's a quote from him in the paper. And keep in mind, my Wyoming Meth Project, publicly funded thing.
Right.
And this newspaper, total right arm of the state. You know, every article is, here's how your tax dollars are going to be spent to make the world more wonderful.
Of course.
Which we're going to talk about your experiences with resting yourself away from.
Right.
But his quote, someone asked him in there, like, how long will the Wyoming Meth Project have to keep being funded and exist? And he said, until there's no more meth in Wyoming.
Okay, great. So using his status as the supposedly independent media to basically say this funding is nonstop forever, because it's impossible to ever, you know, remove a market force or a market demand. The government can't do that. That's like the government trying to get rid of gravity. It's a natural law. One day the market may move away from people wanting meth, and that'll happen completely naturally and regardless of anything the government does. And it's also important to note that, meth is like the new moonshine. You know, when they prohibited alcohol, people made more dangerous type of alcoholic drinks because they had to do it in bathtubs. They had to do it in the black market on the down low. And so meth is basically people cooking up stuff in their bathrooms from chemicals. I don't think it would exist, or at least be as prevalent. I mean, it would probably exist, but I don't think it'd be near the issue it is today as far as drug addiction and all that stuff if we didn't have drug prohibition and a drug war.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is the monopoly of force. You know, I have a good story about how things worked in a situation where there's not a monopoly of force and there's not a monopoly on recovery from drugs and alcohol. This is something I remembered the other day and made a note to talk about. It's when I was in AA, I'm still sober, but I was in AA for like 10 years. I've been sober since 94, off all drugs and alcohol. And I went to AA until about 5 or 6 years ago, and then I just do it on my own now. You know, they say if you do it on your own, you're going to end up killing yourself or relapsing, and I don't believe either is true. I think they kind of say that to, you know, like, hey, you'll be back. But right. I don't think you need it. I think you can use their tools to get away from it and then not need their tools anymore.
That's not to say they're not valuable. Obviously, their tools
no, help you.
Yeah.
They're the only thing that I know of that's worked to get hardcore addicts and hardcore alcoholics sober and clean. Clean and sober, respectively. It's really all the same thing. I mean, NA started because AA didn't want people who were just drug addicts. You know, it's like AA worked. It started in the 30s. The founder of it described it as a mixture of anarchy and democracy. I really like the way it works. And in the 50s and 60s, drug addicts who couldn't get clean any other way started going to AA meetings. And if you said you were a drug addict back then, they'd kick you out of an AA meeting. But a lot of people would just lie.
Yeah.
A lot of people would just lie and substitute in their head and say, I'm an alcoholic, when really they're only an addict.
Okay. But of course, it's the same issue. It's the addiction. The substance is irrelevant.
And really, the reason they didn't let drug addicts, and you know, one of their main traditions, you know, the founding document writings of them says, our primary purpose is to help the alcoholic who still suffers. So they said that addicts coming into meetings trying to get sober conflicted with their primary purpose.
Right.
Because they really, it was like they considered alcoholism a more noble disease than drug addiction because alcohol was legal.
Right. It was above the board. There was less of a stigma against alcoholics. Which is really sad because, you know, at that time, if people had to lie to get into AA, I mean, it seems like, I don't know what the 12 steps are, but I'm sure being honest is part of the whole AA process. And if you have to lie to...
It's about four of the steps is honesty.
Right, and then you have to lie to become a part of the group, which I guess it's really great that they ended up making NA for those people, but...
Well, what they did was they let those people go off and start NA and use the 12 steps and 12 traditions with their blessings.
Okay.
Without asking for money or anything, which is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Because all of their literature is copyrighted and the names are trademarked and everything, which is interesting. They did it to protect it from being diluted, not for money purposes. It was more like they didn't want someone to come out with AA brand whiskey, you know?
Right.
Which would dilute their primary purpose. So, long story short, I used to go to this AA meeting in San Francisco. I went to both AA and NA. I went to this AA meeting in San Francisco. It was the big... A lot of meetings were small and friendly, and they're all friendly, but small and kind of serious, and they'd be like book studies and dimly lit rooms. And then there was this one, like, Tuesday night kind of social meeting that was in a really ritzy neighborhood. It had, like, 300 or 400 people at it. It was, like, everyone wanted to go to that meeting to get their one-year chip or two-year chip or five-year chip or whatever. Because it was like, you know, a room full of people applauding you. And it was very social and jovial. And people actually dressed up for this meeting.
Cool.
It was called the Downtown Meeting. I forget what it's called, but it was some... I'm not going to say what it's called. But it was this meeting in San Francisco. It's been going for like 40 years, and it's still going. There was this chick who was an attorney. I was like 30, and she was like 40 or 42 and really hot. And really, you know, MILFy cougar, recovering alcoholic with several years sober... Kind of like, I looked at her and was like, wow, that's the dream.
Yeah.
You know? And a lot of people did. Like, you know, she dressed in high heels and skirts, like lawyer skirts, to go to meetings.
Right. Like an Ally McBeal type. Okay.
And everyone thought she was just the cat's pajamas. And she became secretary of this meeting. And so this secretary is the leader of the meeting. It's not the person who takes the notes. It's the person that calls it to order and introduces the speaker and closes the meeting.
Right.
And it's a rotating position. Everyone gets it for 6 months, and then they vote someone else in to keep it from becoming someone's meeting, you know, which is the democracy part of it I like. You know, so nobody can say, this is my meeting, you have to do it my way,
right.
Kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And removing ego is a big part of keeping people sober, of that kind of ego. This chick got drunk with power being the secretary of this big popular meeting.
Oh, no.
And didn't want to give it up at 6 months, and they tried to oust her. She brought in a bunch of bikers that were probably still using drugs that weren't even meeting people that she knew from her old using days.
Huh.
And had them come, like, strong arm the meeting.
Wow.
to keep people from. It's so un-AA.
So she was drunk on the power. She was still an addict, but she had found a new drug.
She wasn't doing drugs or alcohol, but she was like drunk on being the queen of this meeting. Yeah. It was weird because she was everybody's friend and everyone thought she was really cool and really sensible and had a lot of recovery. And she just pulled this insane move. And what happened, instead of her being able to strong arm the meeting, was people stopped going to that meeting on Tuesday nights and went to other meetings on Tuesday nights.
Good, good. There you go. There's your market anarchy aspect of it.
Yeah. Right. And within a month, there weren't 300 people at that meeting. There were 12 or 10 people at that meeting.
Right. And they were probably old friends of hers. And
yeah. Yeah. And a couple people who'd been going to the meeting for 40 years, you know.
Right.
And said, I'm not going to leave. And probably a few people who just made popcorn and wanted to see how it would all play out. So that's my story of free market, you know, in organizations on something that resembles sort of a government in a way, an ad hoc government for one purpose that's voluntary.
Right, right. Exactly. And the people were free to leave. I mean, they weren't required to make sure they go to certain AA locations. You know, it was free form. They could say, well, I don't like the way this one's being run, you know, which is sort of the idea of panarchy that we've talked about in CAST before. You should be, if you want a government, by all means, go and form it wherever, on your own private property or a conglomeration of other people's private property, as long as they all agree to it.
I want to start calling myself a panarchist because the word anarchy, I go back and forth with this all the time, but it's like most people who, I looked at this site today, some anarchist site that's like really popular, and it's like a lot of it's about hating on anarcho-capitalists. It's all left socialism anarchists.
They're like, we're the real anarchists.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They can have it, man. We're the panarchists.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I guess the ideas are what's important to me. But, you know, people do use labels as shorthand. I mean, we only have so much mental space. We only have so much attention to devote to certain things. That's why stereotypes do exist and can be useful. I mean, I think you should recognize and be self-conscious of that when you're making a decision based on a mental shortcut. But I think a lot of times people do hear anarchists and they think dudes in black balaclavas, you know, smashing up police cars and being violent.
Which we're going to talk about this movie, The Bader-Meinhof Syndrome, at some point, which is about that, which is directed by Uli Adel, who is... anyway, I wanted to finish up the AA lady story.
Yeah.
The meeting went from 300 people down to 10 people, and she quit coming, and then one of the 10 guys that was still there said, well, she didn't show up today, I'll sit up here this week and do it. The next week, she didn't show up, and then word got out, and then the next week, they had regular elections, and there were 300 people back there, and it was run smoothly again.
Nice, nice. Another great market thing. I mean, when something is bad about something and it starts to fail, like banks or an industry, sometimes once the leadership fails and the assets are taken over by somebody else, then it can resurge. It's, you know, things don't fail and then die, and those resources don't get put to use.
If AA were run by the government, they would have come in there with soldiers and thrown out her soldiers and, you know, installed their own dictator.
Right, and said, we're taking this over, and then said, well, everybody who lives in this radius and is an AA member will be forced to come to this meeting and will be forced to pay dues of this amount. And if they don't pay their dues, then we're going to inject them with alcohol.
So I think you're about to start to get into the concept of rivalry, the economic concept of rivalry. And non-excludable goods. Do you know about that?
I might have been.
Oh, I heard you. You just didn't know it.
I think what I was really getting at was that, you know, the market is really nature, and it's really run by natural law, basically. So, you know, whereas in nature you see an animal dies, that doesn't mean that those nutrients and that matter and that organic material that the animal was built on ceases to exist. It doesn't become antimatter and disappear. It gets used by fungus and dung beetles and what have you. It's still there. All that energy is still in existence. It just goes into other sources and gets used by other things that use it productively. The economy works the same way. And when you prop something up like a bank and you bail it out, then you have a zombie. And it's abomination. And it's never going to be productive. It's always just going to suck money away. So the idea is to let that life cycle continue. And it works in the economy just the same way it works in nature.
Yes. So we were talking earlier about the media propping up the state. Do you have a little announcement to make and some talk to do about it?
I do, actually. Yeah, I am free. I am not only a freedom fiend in my mind and in my heart, but I am economically free and professionally free from being a shill for the mainstream media. I have formally resigned my post at a CBS affiliate I was working for as a TV reporter. You can bleep that out, but it was a network affiliate I was working for. As of this week, I am no longer an employee.
We're not going to read your take this job and shove it letter you used to quit yet.
No, though. I don't. I think we should wait until all the legal
dust settles.
Make sure that's all settled. I don't want to badmouth anybody. But I do want to say, as far as the industry goes, the mainstream media, a lot of lip service is paid to this idea of objectivity. And I will tell you that the biggest bias for the mainstream media isn't necessarily left or right.
It's the state.
It's the state. It's the status quo. What's the thing people always say makes news? It's man bites dog. It's something unusual. But at the same time, I can't go out and do a story on free market ideas or something that really works because it doesn't fit within that framework.
No, the real story most of the time would be man bites dog, government forms committee to deal with it, you know?
Right, right. And it does get formulaic and repetitive. It's go get a soundbite from government official A, go get a soundbite from somebody on the street who wants more money or who is crying about their services being cut. That's another big bias about mainstream media, is a lot of times, you know, economists, free market economists, they talk about what really matters is what's unseen. It's the opportunity cost missed out on a government spending program. And yet what you see when government spending is cut is the people who get their welfare cut, or the people standing in line for their food stamps that don't get it, or the people who lose their unemployment benefits. Those are the people that are out there on the street and are vocal and who get the airtime. And so then all your stories have to become about, and you know, when we're going over story ideas and looking for things, we look at that. We say, okay, budget cuts coming, $1 billion in cuts from the state. Go out and find who this is affecting. And then that's the lens that those stories get portrayed through. Because in the format of mainstream news, it's all about finding that person to personalize the story with. I can pitch a story that's great, but if it doesn't have a person, I can say, oh, well, this person is affected to it and they're going to cry about it on air. Then the story doesn't get approved.
Unless it's a puppy parade, which is what I call the last 2 minutes of any newscast, where they say, you know, and it often actually has puppies in it, and sometimes in a parade.
Or squirrels water skiing, or, the like.
The feel-good story.
I mean, that really doesn't come into play for my part of the job. Usually they just pull those kind of things off some server somewhere that somebody else has shot.
The national feed.
So what you end up doing is you end up telling these stories, and they portray in a negative light anytime there's government budget cuts, anytime that the government does something or does save money, you have to portray it in a good light as, oh, well, look at the government. They're saving all your taxpayer dollars. Isn't that great? They didn't spend this amount of money. Yay.
Ron Paul kind of nailed that in the debates last night. And I've quit watching the debates. All I do now is watch the Ron Paul clip show that people put together on YouTube.
Right, the highlights, me too.
I'll link that. And he really nailed it, where he was asked, like, well, what are you going to do for the Hispanic vote? And he just nailed it. He was like, that's the problem, is the form of government we have divides people up into groups and pits them against each other, and everyone, it's not groups. It's basically, why let the government take away this freedom or grant you this freedom to this group?
Right,
you know?
Right.
I don't know. I'm poorly paraphrasing.
The other problem I have with the main format of mainstream media is, you know, supposedly things are unbiased, but a lot of times when you go to get both sides of the story, both sides you get are statists.
Yeah, they're really not unbiased. I mean, if you want proof, look at the two mainstream left and right so-called news. You know, right is Fox, left is MSNBC. Look at them both, and they're both yelling at each other, saying they've both got it wrong, but they're also both saying the government has to take care of this and point its guns at the other people to protect
us. Well, there's a narrow spectrum, and I think Tom Woods put it best when he says that the debate is between Hillary Clinton on one end and Mitch McConnell on the other end. Anything to the left or right or up or down of that is off limits for debate. And the other thing is, it's almost like the legal profession. I mean, you can't bring up constitutional arguments, really, in a court of law, not to much effect. And in the media, you can't really bring philosophical arguments to bear. You can't say, well, this is wrong because it violates the non-aggression principle. You can't do that. Not enough people know what the non-aggression principle is, and most mainstream media outlets, they just want to portray whatever their customers or their viewers or whatever they think their viewers want to see. They don't want to push the envelope. They don't want to really inform people. They want to reassure people. And that's not...
You're on fire, Nima. You're on fire.
Am I? Well, that's... Yeah, I feel passionately about this, and that's not what I want to do with my life.
You've been let out of a cage, or more like shot out of a gun.
Yeah, exactly. And I got sick of it. I wasn't feeling morally good about what I was doing. And a lot of the times, you know, after I'd get my track back to read for my package when I'd be doing the voiceover, I would say sentences that I did not feel comfortable saying. Sentences that I knew in my heart were wrong philosophically or were sensationalized in ways that I didn't agree with. And in the end, you know, I use this metaphor. I was like a vegetarian in a slaughterhouse or a pacifist doing an ad campaign for the Marines. It was just not a sustainable situation. And I feel free now. I'm working for a company, not necessarily doing media yet, but there's a lot of opportunity for advancement, so who knows. But I'm working for a company that I feel proud of working and that I think anybody could be proud of, and people who are freedom lovers love this company.
It's an e-commerce. It's a huge e-commerce.
Right. I don't really want to say who they are, but you've probably used them.
Would you say that, yeah, I mean, I use them a lot. Would you say that working for this company is a forest of liberty or even a rainforest of liberty?
I would, and I'd say that there is a giant river of freedom running through it on a daily basis.
And there are giant women, strong women running it. No, wait, that's another kind of the same
right.
thing.
Right. Well, hopefully our listeners get the idea. I feel like I can do some good in the world working for a company like that. And I feel like it's forward-facing. I feel like the mainstream media is a dinosaur. It just like the government is the giant dinosaur biting its own tail. The mainstream media is... People don't even trust it anymore, you know? And most people, I think, in the future are going to want to hear their ideas from people like us.
And, you know, I'd like to interject here that our DVD is available for pre-order on Amazon.com. That's Amazon.com.
It sure is. You should definitely go out and cop.
So you can't say where you're working, but here's a little ad for our DVD.
Since time began, tyrants have taken aim at personal liberties. Now there's a movie that aims back.
The government has no more right to tell us what to put in our bodies than they have to take our guns or tell us what books we can read.
Six drug police were eaten by bears while raiding a marijuana farm.
On your knees, you dirty hippies!
Jesus.
On your knees!
What's the problem, officer?
Today, many cops who enforce pot laws do so only because it provides them with cushy jobs, good benefits, and a chance to push people around.
I was an undercover narcotics officer. The drug war is nothing but a farce.
The Second Amendment says you gotta keep you and your gat intact.
Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. A film by Michael W. Dean and Nima Vedati.
DVD ships by or before December 6th. Available for pre-order at gunsandweed.com or on Amazon. Makes the perfect holiday gift. Remember, that's gunsandweed.com.
I just wanted to say that I haven't given up media.
You're doing media right now. You're soaking in it right now.
I'd much rather podcast than broadcast. I'd much rather talk about philosophy and freedom and the things I believe in and comment from what I believe is the right point of view than try to find the lowest common denominator and itch people's crazy cat spots, which is what, you know, broadcasting is. It's trying to reach the largest number of people, and the common denominators are things like being scared of child molesters or things like that. It's not big philosophical questions, because that goes over the head of a lot of people.
And you actually went to college for this, and you wanted to do this, and you got a job right out of college. You hit the ball out of the park. You've had two really good, quote unquote, jobs doing it, that there's probably people that were in your class that are still trying to get their first job, and you're already done with it after what, 2.5 years?
About 3 years, yeah. You know, in Wyoming, when I was working at the station there, things were a bit different. I had a lot more creative freedom. And people in Wyoming, they get freedom more than others. I mean, I won't say I was necessarily pushing the ideas of anarcho-capitalism.
You were hinting it, and you did gun stories.
I was hinting it, and I got to choose my own words. I got to choose my own angles. And I feel like this is not just the station that I was working at here now that is going to prevent me from doing that. I think that's what happens in the industry as you move up. You have more and more restraint and more control on what you write, to where I didn't feel like it was my stories I was putting out. It was my editor's stories I was putting out. And then they have my name on them. And then they're there to live on the web forever. As Nima Vedati said this, I didn't really say that. I didn't write that. The editor wrote that, and I had to say it. So,
well, there's a story happening in Wyoming that is indicative of why Wyoming is cooler than a lot of other places in a lot of ways. And you would be able to cover this at your old job here, and you wouldn't be able to touch this at the job you just quit in Washington. There is a guy running in the Republican primary. He's going to run against Barrasso, senator, you know, federal senator Barrasso.
Yes,
first time anyone's ever run against him. The guy's a Vietnam vet. He was a soldier of fortune. He served 22 months in a prison for attempting to assassinate Noriega as a soldier of fortune. He's 65. Uh-huh. He's a retired soldier of fortune. And he's running against Barrasso, saying Barrasso isn't constitutional enough. And this guy plans to tour the state running for governor and campaigning with an AK-47 strapped across his back.
Okay. I could probably cover that at my last job here, but the idea would be to make him look
crazy.
Ridiculous.
But here you could probably do it as a, isn't that quaint and that's how our state is, which is a little less ridiculous.
Right. Or let's hear his ideas. Why does he believe that Barrasso's not constitutional? Then maybe we could actually look at the constitutional voting record of Senator Barrasso.
Speaking, you know, Barrasso is, I like him a lot better than, you know, Feinstein or whoever was my senator in California. Right. I didn't even pay attention enough to know. Barrasso is pro-Second Amendment in an NRA kind of way. And he's fiscally, you know, fiscally responsible in a Western state kind of Republican way, which is, you know, kind of like, you know, we don't want to fund everything for the whole country and pay for all the crack babies, but we must have our public schools strong and our police force strong and our military forces strong.
Well, he reminds me of that, I don't know if it's a Boston paraphrase or a Boston quote, but the idea of, you know, the problem isn't necessarily Democrats.
It's Republicans who haven't willing yet to become libertarians.
Right. And that's what I feel about Barrasso. I mean, I've met him a bunch of times. I met him on my first day at the job in Wyoming, shook hands with him. He's a really nice guy, slick like a politician, but he does pay lip service to more, you know, fiscally conservative ideas. It's always half measures. It's more playing along the surface than striking at the root. You know, he'll say things like, well, when it comes to government health care, we need to make sure there's no waste and fraud. Yeah. Not necessarily.
It shouldn't be.
The government shouldn't be providing these things.
And he's a doctor, too.
Right. He is. Dr. John Barrasso. He does little doctoral updates or medical tips for the public that they play on TV in Wyoming.
There's a signed 8x10 glossy of him at a Thai place I like to go to. It's funny.
Yeah. Well, Wyoming's such a small place. Everybody has a picture of them with some politician.
Yeah, and it's like you and I went shooting with the governor, you know. Right. I showed his 11-year-old daughter how to use my revolver.
Right, right. Yeah, that was fun times. Yep. And then, you know, the other thing everybody who has an office in Wyoming, the head of the office usually has a picture of themselves shaking hands with Dick Cheney.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's the way things work in Wyoming. Yeah. What else?
Speaking of constitutionalism, did you read that thing, Ravers versus the Man, California bans LED gloves and pacifiers?
I saw the blurb. I saw the headline. So is this like a statewide ban on – how do you ban pacifiers exactly? Or this is only LED pacifiers?
It's basically, there's a senator or congresswoman there who was worried about raves and the problem of raves, and she tried to pass a law to outlaw techno music in that state. And this lady's Chinese, and she's second generation. Her grandfather is the mayor of some big town in China. I'm thinking she just called him up and said, Grandpa, what should I do? And he said, oh, here, we've just banned that. And she said, thanks, Grandpa. You know, and then someone pointed out to her in the legislature that it was unconstitutional to ban a form of music. And she was surprised. So she just outlawed LED gloves and pacifiers, which I don't know how that's any more constitutional. But, you know, California, whatever's not banned is required, and whatever's not required is banned.
Right, right. Well, it also goes to show you the weakness of a piece of paper to guarantee your human freedoms. I mean, obviously it seems anti-freedom to ban anything or to prevent people from selling anything, especially something like
gloves
and pacifiers. And yet, because it wasn't specifically in the Bill of Rights that you can't ban gloves and pacifiers, people think it's okay or it's constitutional. And maybe it is constitutional, but it certainly isn't. It's not free. You know, a free society wouldn't do something like that.
Yeah. Did you see? I got another one. It's about district tyrannies. I'm sorry. United States tyrannies going after free speech. Did you read that? The Obama thing?
And this is from the Seattle Times, right?
Yeah, Seattle Weekly. That's the same one that Chris Novoselic does his blog in and said I was a great musician. But anyway, okay. I digress. Okay.
And this is a federal crackdown on marijuana advertising.
Yeah. Local newspapers that advertise medical marijuana clinics, they're going after them.
Wow. Which, you know, I do see a lot here in Washington State, even in the conservative type, quote unquote, conservative type place I live in. There is one ad for a place that does, you know, do referrals for medical marijuana. And so I'm guessing that these are the kinds of things they'd go after. And, you know, the ad just says, got pain, chronic pain. We have an alternative for you. Come see if medical marijuana is right for you. You know, it's not saying smoke drugs or anything like that.
Well, they look at it like it is, like it's saying nod, nod. Wink, wink, smoke drugs. And so what if it were, man?
Right,
why
exactly.
Why the f- is so that illegal in this day and age? And
not only
how many
that,
old people are going to, statist fucks are going to have to die before people go, okay, let's just have a vote. Or even, why do you need a vote? But, you know,
right.
Without changing
And it's
that-
very sad. And also, how do you not get the free speech angle of this? I mean, you should be able to put any ad in the newspaper that pretty much promotes anything, as far as I'm concerned. And, you know, the great thing about the first sentence of this article is the director of the Marijuana Policy Project calling President Obama the worst president so far on marijuana.
I know. That's saying a lot, man. That's, what, worse than Nixon? He probably is, though, because Nixon didn't have the resources we have now.
That's true. You know? And, you know, we have seen the DOJ cracking down on the dispensaries in California. Horrible thing to see. The president, as one of his campaign promises, said that this would not be a priority. He never said he'd go so far as to decriminalize anything. But he did mention that he would not make this a priority for the Department of Justice or any federal agency to go after sick people. Obama, during the campaign,
Didn't the New York chief of police just say something like that too, that he wanted them to not make it a priority to go after small-time marijuana users or personal amount marijuana users. The same week, here's another headline. We fabricated drug charges against innocent people to meet arrest quotas, former New York detective testifies.
I did see that, and that was – I think we all sort of knew that that kind of thing happened, and I think that this guy is a hero for admitting it. I mean, he's obviously scum for being involved in this, but – at least somebody has made that public. And I think one of the cases they mentioned were, you know, two guys were in a bar. There was an officer who wasn't meeting his buy and bust, which I guess is what they call it, quota, or his numbers. He wasn't hitting his metrics, you know, as they'd say in business. And so his supervisor helped set up a thing where they were going to plant some coke on some guys. And these guys got in trouble. And, you know, also this guy could get an extra number so he could save his career or make sure he didn't get put back
Ruining someone's life.
Right.
Over and over and over with different people every week to keep a fucking job.
Right. And that is a great example. All these government enforcers really are parasites, and in more ways than one. It's not just that they're paid by taxing you, not just that they get all their income from stealing the public's money, but also that they will ruin lives. They will suck the lives out of people and throw them in cages so that they can continue to get their bread and butter, and they can continue their career and feed their families and buy their nice trucks and houses.
I have a fun thing about drugs that I just saw was I think it was on History Channel or Documentary Channel. It was a documentary about crack. It was fairly unbiased and did talk about decriminalizing and, you know, but it was like the government should be spending money on treatment, not incarceration. And I'm like, they shouldn't spend money on either. You know, education and treatment. That's what the statists that think they're hip always go for. But in this, you know how they put people in shadow and then alter their voice to anonymize them? In this movie, they did that. But instead of using the pitch shifter to garble their voice, they used auto-tune. It made all the women sound like Whitney Houston and all the men sound like Will.i.am, and it just it made them sound like really hip, and it looked like they were singing their interviews.
That's great.
I know.
I think that's genius. I love
it. It was weird.
Yeah.
It kind of made me feel like I was on coke.
Right, right. Or on any or kind of mind-altering drug.
What I've read drugs are like.
Well, okay. I can dig that.
I saw a good documentary. I've had this on my notes for months. A good documentary about police and drugs and hip-hop. It's called Black and Blue, Legends of the Hip-Hop Cop. It's a Russell Simmons documentary about the NYPD and Miami police having a rap unit to target hip-hop musicians.
Ugh.
You should look for that on Hulu. I don't know if it's on there, but you could get it on Amazon. I'll link that. It's really good. Right.
I feel like officials in Florida are really bad on the drug war. When I was working as a reporter in Wyoming, I think it was Broward County or one of the really bad counties as far as drug enforcement. You know, some law enforcement official came and gave a speech about prescription drugs and this and that. And she flat out said, "We are never going to get rid of the demand for drugs."
Yeah, that's why I laughed when I read in the paper today, the head of the paper, the publisher of the paper, saying in his capacity as the meth project leader, you know, another tax eater, which may be voluntary. I don't know that he's getting paid for that, but it just seems weird and wrong and conflict of interest to me. But he said, you know, someone asked him, how long will we have to continue the Wyoming meth project? And he said, until we've eradicated meth in Wyoming. And I'm like, so you're saying your job is secure for life?
Exactly. And that was the point that this woman brought up. It wasn't a negative to her that they were never going to get rid of the demand for drugs or people using prescription drugs without a prescription. That didn't bug her at all. It wasn't, oh my God, we're failing miserably, we should cut our losses, or maybe this isn't something we should be trying to pursue. It was more like, yay, perpetual war. We can all have our militarized budgets and throw as much money at this and make sure we do this. And she basically said that. So we need to make sure we get our budgets bigger. She didn't say it in so much words, but make sure we try hard to crack down on this and just keep making arrests. You know, that was the big thing for her was let's just make as many arrests as we can and just keep this going.
Boston put it really well in his book, You and the Police. He said that the police industry, the prison industrial complex, prison right. police, whatever you want to call it, he said it's in search of warm bodies to push through its system.
Yeah, it really is.
And that's how you should look at any cop talking to you ever. He's looking to see if he can throw you in a cage and push you through the system to be another number on his quota, or even if they don't have quotas per se, which I believe are illegal.
Technically,
but
I mean,
they have them. You know, if you don't bust anybody as a cop, if you just go around saying hello to everyone in the neighborhood, you're not going to be a cop long.
Right, right.
If you just go spreading goodwill, you know, you have to make people scared.
If you just try to serve and protect,
yeah.
which is what they say they do.
Another one of like, is this a thing to, you know, scare people and keep the money flowing? The alleged Iranian plot. Do you know about that one? It's another like,
I do know.
Could
about
be just
that
a Muslim off the boat, as you once said. Kind of in a kind of racist way, although I guess since you have Muslim cousins, you can say that.
Right. This was kind of personally scary for me because the guy was a used car salesman.
Because it was a Persian guy from Texas.
A Persian guy from Texas who sold used cars. I have an uncle who does that. I mean, he's obviously not this guy and he's not an alcoholic.
You have a Persian
whatever
uncle
they,
from Texas who sells
who
used
sells
cars.
Yeah. And from everybody I've heard on this, I listen to a lot of antiwar.com and Scott Horton, and he has a lot of great guys in the know on this. People like Eric Margolies, Gareth Porter, who's the other guy, Michael Shore, you know, people who used to be in the CIA, who just say this is ridiculous. Nobody who's in the know buys the story that this had deep connections
CNN
to the
CNN is doubting
government.
It.
Are they really? Yes. Okay. See, at first, everybody was eating it up. And that's part of the problem with the media is, you know, a high official comes up with a source, and because they want to get the scoop and come to air with it, they just parrot what the guy says.
Terrorism.
You know, somebody's telling us this. And then, you know, it's that crazy
Muslims.
Cat complex.
Muslims.
People are scared. Yeah. Oh, and Iran, you know, that's a hot button. You know, oh, the Iranians are involved. And then you go run stories and run file video of them testing.
Why would the Iranians want to kill the Saudi whatever anyway? Aren't they kind of on the same side of some things?
No, not really. Pretty much everybody in the Middle East hates the Saudi government, except for, you know, the other Gulf states that are in the same boat.
Saudi Arabia is kind of the America of the Middle East, like the rich empire.
Well, they're the foothold, you know, and the only reason, I feel the only reason the Saudi royal family, I mean, think about that, a royal family in charge of the country.
I know.
who can fathom that? And the only reason that they're really still in power is because of their relationship with the American government.
Speaking of relationships with the American government, you know this week that Israel exchanged like over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners for one Israeli soldier?
Oh, I did not know that, no. I'd heard about the plan.
I'm kind of surprised because it really seems, I think of Israel as like, in another way, the America of the Middle East. You know, we fund them heavily and all politicians have to say they love them to get elected.
Right. Well, some people call them the 51st state and some more accurate people call them the first state.
In what way?
In the way that they have more power over the federal government through their lobbying force than, say, Texas or New York. Yeah.
But it kind of surprised me because I don't think America would do that. And Israel just seems like the America of the Middle East in a different way than the Saudi family.
Well, I mean, Israel
does.
Is a nation of, you know, 7 million or whatever people. And they have their factions and they have their people that have different opinions. You know, they're not a monolith. And there are divisions on the way to handle policy. And Israel pretty much right now is more isolated than it's ever been in the Middle East. And so maybe they're trying to make some sort of concession or they're having to change the way they're operating. I mean, they don't have a compliant Egypt as much as they used to. Turkey has had really strained relationships with Israel lately. And those are two giant allies that used to be in Israel's tool bag no matter what.
And then there's Jordan. And speaking of Jordan and sexy German terrorists.
No, wait, we were talking about supposed Iranian terror plot, which I do want to reiterate that most of the people that are in the know realize that this guy probably had no real ties to Iranian intelligence. If he did, it was from a long time ago. He had been selling used cars in Texas and failing at it for years. This isn't the kind of guy that the Iranians would go to in the first place. Second of all, it was another one of these agent provocateur things.
They'd go to some soldier of fortune, you know, who's trained in doing something other than selling used cars.
Not only that, but, you know, this guy didn't even have a plan to necessarily kill this Saudi guy. He just, you know, he was an angry, upset guy, and a couple of undercover FBI agents get involved and try to push him to do things, you know, like we've seen time and time again with them going to young, upset Muslims and saying, hey, don't you want to blow this up? Here's a bomb. Here's a way to do it. You know, think about it. And then they say, oh, it's a plan. He was plotting this. But really, it's the FBI who plotted it.
In those cases, they even admit that the feds went to him and, you know, those guys in New York you're talking about, they went to them and said, it was entrapment, you know, in any lower court, that would have been entrapment.
Right,
but
right.
Speaking of Jordanian training camps,
we're just going to throw random segs out now. That's how we're going to do it here at Freedom Fiends.
Yeah, it's like now if we had it as a call-in show, we could have people just call in with a random sentence and we'd have to talk about it. You know, speaking of, well, okay, we're not speaking of it. I'm trying to tie everything together. You know how the Fox News corporate Tea Party has co-opted everything cool about Ron Paul and libertarianism and mutated it.
Sanitized it, I guess, would be the proper word.
Vanillized
right.
it, taking the blood and the life out of it.
Yeah.
It's like no butt rock and roll, you know?
Right.
Rock and roll that has loud guitars but sucks. It's kind of like that. I heard Hannity use the word statist the other day regarding the Occupy Wall Street people.
Huh.
Amazing.
Yeah. Well,
Hannity's one of the most statist people I can think of.
He is, but, you know, like a lot, and I think this is part of the trying to co-opt it, is they'll speak the language for one issue. You know,
right.
He'll say statist and he'll disagree with statist, but then when it comes to foreign policy or the police state, he'll be like, oh, we gotta make sure we throw the drug dealers in jail or whatever. You know, he doesn't talk like he's from Jersey, but you get the idea.
I'm not against it, though. I think it's a good thing. I don't think it's going to dilute things so much as it's going to make people go, what does that word mean? And look it up on Wikipedia or something.
I hope so. I hope they Google it and it comes up in our glossary. Yeah.
They'll find us.
Exactly.
The anti-statist.
And so I think that's good. And I think that's how ideas progress. You know, some of the ideas or the verbiage gets spoken by the mainstream, not necessarily in the accurate way and not necessarily ideologically consistently. But once it's there, it can grow.
So I got another one of those letters, spam. Are you cocking your beer or your gun?
I was. No, that was my beer. That was Bush. But the good one, kind I can drink and enjoy.
So I got another one of those snail mail spam letters that tries to make it look like the government sent it so you'll open it. You've never gotten one of these, huh?
No, I haven't, but I've never put in my change of address form. So I don't know if I'm slated for that.
You also, I think we have more credit than you, so they think we have more money, even though it's all going into the house, but you know.
Right, right.
They think we could buy cars, but we can't.
Okay.
Okay, the return address on this is all capital letters, and it says the offices of Records of Declaration Distributions Division, National Correspondence Official Records, and then an
that
address.
Sounds like it could be any statist organization as far as I'm concerned.
Yep. It looks like it's from the IRS to me. It looks like it's a refund check from the IRS or a bill.
Does it have some kind of seal or logo that's all circular and creepy looking?
No, but when you open it up, it looks like a bureaucratic form that's been typed in and had things circled by pen.
Huh. Okay.
And it says, dealer asset disposal event. Michael, you are a guaranteed recipient. And it's for a car.
Ah.
It's for a used car company. They're trying to sell me used cars. And it says on the back that I'm a guaranteed recipient of two of the following: a digital webcam, which could be worth about $1 these days,
yeah,
or a $5,000 instant scratch ticket, which is worthless, or a home theater system, or another instant scratch ticket, or $10,000 in cash.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah, I think they give you the bogus ticket and the $2 webcam if you get on test drive a car.
Yeah, I don't think you'll be responding to that. You're not a guaranteed recipient of any of that because you're not going to be heading there.
I've already got a box of cheap webcams I never use.
Yeah, me too. I've got a whole box of cheap, old, outdated equipment that I never use. I should probably toss it sometime.
I usually donate that stuff to... In L.A., near my house, there was this thing called the Echo Park Film Center, which was a... They were kind of lefty, but they were really good people, and they got donations and, I guess, used government money, which at the time, you know... But they had free filmmaking classes for kids from the neighborhood, like mostly Mexican kids. And it was, I liked the play. And they had a little theater with like 20 seats. And I used to donate all my old equipment to them.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good.
Yeah. And now I donate it to Kofi, but I have to send it to Ghana. Whereas in LA, I'd take it in my backpack on my bicycle 4 blocks away.
Right. Well, we're trying to push freedom globally now, you know?
Yeah. It costs more.
Freedom ain't free, Michael.
Speaking of sexy German anarchist terrorists and PLO Palestinian training camps in Jordan.
We are always speaking about those things, Michael.
We're never speaking about those things, but we're going to tonight. We're going to talk about a movie called The Bader-Meinhof Complex, which is a fucking amazing movie, and I wish you could see it. I think people need to start donating to Freedom Fiends so Nima can get Netflix, so we can watch the same movies and sort of add a punk rock Siskel and Ebert, an anarchist Siskel and Ebert section each cast.
We could do that. We could do, you know, libertarian movie reviews. Yeah, I'm not opposed to that.
I'd have to get Hulu and you'd have to get Netflix. We can't just have each have the other, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's like you're Mac and I'm PC 20 years ago. They don't talk to each other. Did you know that Steve Jobs' next computer company was called NEXT? It was when he got fired from Apple before he got hired back to save the company. He started this company called Next, which built Unix workstations that were incredibly powerful and cost a lot of money, and only nerds got them. Did you know that company was funded by Ross Perot?
By Ross Perot, huh?
Yeah. Who has an interesting... He's the only independent that's ever been able to buy himself into the debate where it's just the two candidates, you know?
Right. Yeah, I vaguely remember that when I was a kid. I was actually a Ross Perot fan.
There were three candidates up there.
Yeah, I was. I was a kid. I must have been under the age of 7 or right around there.
He's got a weird mix of platforms. I mean, he's pro-free market in that Republican kind of way, but more so than even most small government Republicans.
I was real young, but I always remember him having charts and talking about the deficit and the debt and how, you know, we were gonna, it's all gonna come crashing down kind of if we don't make some changes. And for some reason, that spoke to me even then when I was, you know, an 8-year-old.
Yeah, he saw half the picture, which is more than most politicians see, but he's also fiercely pro-war on drugs. Yeah,
there's the rub.
But he was like, he basically was like a Republican that was fiercely pro-choice. It was kind of a weird mixture,
okay,
you know?
Okay.
But the Bader-Meinhof Complex.
Now, is that the name of a complex somewhere that's named after a couple guys or what?
Bader-Meinhof are the names of two people, and one of them was the member of this terrorist organization, and another is a journalist who was covering the organization like what you did, like the statist news person,
okay,
but then got sucked in by their message and joined them.
Huh. All right.
And I think that the term Bader-Meinhof complex is sort of a variation on Stockholm syndrome, but instead of being seduced by the ideals and joining your kidnappers, it's the same thing, but with people you're covering from the outside, not kidnapped by.
I see.
You kidnap yourself into them.
Right, right.
I'm going to link the trailer. The trailer kind of doesn't do it justice. It's got a lot of, it makes it look like an action movie. It's actually...
A documentary?
More of a biopic.
Okay.
It's directed by Uli Edel, who directed Last Exit to Brooklyn, the Hubert Selby book turned into a movie, first movie. Selby had two books turned into a movie. It was that one and Requiem for a Dream. Darren Aronofsky directed it. And then there's this other one where Selby wrote a movie with a Scandinavian director. It's called Fear X, lesser known movie. But Uli Edel is a really stellar director. He also did this movie called Christian F about this teenage prostitute, heroin addict. He did a mini series, The Mists of Avalon, which was a kind of purple capey swords and King Arthur, but from the perspective of the female characters. It was a really popular TV miniseries.
Okay.
And I've met him and I've been to his house and interviewed him and kind of hung out with him afterwards. I have this really great picture of him standing behind me holding an actual like sharp broadsword to my throat, like something you could cut someone's fucking head off with,
yikes,
like holding it to my throat. I'll use that for the picture for this cast because it'll just make people go, what the fuck? Is that?
It's our terrorist training video.
It looks like one. I look horrified in it, but I'm acting. It was a prop from his Mists of Avalon series.
Okay.
And but this movie, Bader Meinhof Complex, I'd seen Last Exit to Brooklyn, you know, decade when it came out, but I hadn't seen this movie until recently. It's on Netflix. It is an amazing movie. It's 2.5 hours long. It's very well done. It's a pretty accurate depiction of this group of terrorists that spontaneously happened in Germany in the 70s and went on this like decade-long killing spree of public officials. And, you know, we don't condone that, but it's a very interesting document to watch this. And the people in it, the people in the reality, you know, that the movie's based on were young, sexy, college student, rebel types. And they're portrayed like that in the movie.
And they were Germans, right?
German.
Yeah.
And they were really lefty, like Marxist, kind of. They didn't really have a clear, like, you could put a label on it kind of philosophy, except they hated the government.
Well, it looks like what they started off being angry about was the Shah of Iran in the 60s visiting Berlin, and then they wanted to protest the Shah coming because, you know, he's...
There was a demonstration, right, and then someone got shot by a cop. One of the peaceful demonstrators got shot and killed by a cop. It was all a reaction to that. You know, it wasn't like last week in L.A., some homeless guy got shot on Skid Row. Like he was cutting up some drugs with a knife and the cops said, drop the knife, and they killed him from a safe distance. And, you know, people are demanding an inquiry. It's like these people didn't demand an inquiry. They started fucking blowing shit up and shooting people and just, I mean, blatant, brazen, just like running into people's homes and killing them and blowing up public buildings. And they didn't get caught for a long time, but once they got caught, kind of copycat people took up the torch and ran with it. And it just fucked Germany up for like a decade. And Germany actually made some political changes because of it.
Huh. But again, violence doesn't make things better.
But it's interesting.
it is very interesting. And it's also interesting that people... to note that people react to violence with violence, which is why violence doesn't work. It becomes a chain. So when you use things like a monopoly of force to kill a bad guy or shoot a protester or you have collateral damage, you end up creating these kinds of things and you create these reactions. And that's not to justify the violence of the people who end up, you know, seeking revenge, but it's to show that when you do things that are violent, all it does is breed more violence.
One of the cute things in this movie, one of the things I thought was humorous, and there is humor in this movie, and Uli Edel admits, you know, he has the same conclusion that we do, that, like, he's horrified by this. I mean, he was a young guy in Germany in his 20s. He was the age of these people in Germany when this was happening. He grew up there. You know, he remembers it like you remember anything that's happened in your life, but more so.
Yeah.
Because it was so in everyone's face.
Right.
But he was in college, you know, when they were doing this and was like kind of sympathetic with them or at least fascinated by them. Like, wow, I'm out protesting with signs and they're not just talking,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
It's just an interesting movie. And one of the cute, funny things in it, I mean, there are people going to be horrified at me saying this is cute, but they went and trained with the PLO. Like after they'd done a bunch of stuff and got some notoriety, the PLO terrorist whatever group, Muslim group in, this was in Jordan, these German young people went over to train with them, and the Jordanians ended up kicking them out because they were like, the Germans were like, freewheel, you know, the women were trying to stay in the same place with the men, the PLO people were Muslim, yeah. They were smoking hash, they were drinking, they were, you know, f***ing on the rooftops.
They were being German,
they were being Western, they weren't disciplined, right, you know, right. There's a scene where, like, the PLO guys are firing AKs around them while the Germans are crawling on their bellies under a fence holding AKs, and one of the Germans just jumps up and says, f*** this, we're urban terrorists, we want to rob banks, we're not going to run around in the desert, you know, they don't want to train.
Okay. So yeah, that definitely sounds like something I should check out, and you should check out.
It's a great movie, you know.
Sounds great, man. It's not great that, you know, there's this terrorist organization, but it sounds like it would be an interesting watch.
It's an interesting movie, and I've met the guy, and he's really cool and really humble for someone is, you know, a lot of people in America don't know what he is, but he's the kind of guy that, like, walks down the street in Europe and he's mobbed.
And of course, this movie is in German, right? So you're gonna have to watch it with subtitles.
It's got subtitles, but it's pretty easy to follow with, so, you know, it's not wall to wall talking and, yeah.
Right. Okay.
You know, Europe's weird that way. I was in a restaurant, I was in a restaurant having dinner with Robert Towne, the one of the co-writers of The Godfather, Part 1, 2, and 3.
Oh, cool.
And a bunch of other movies. And actually, he didn't do 1, 2, and 3. He did 1 and 2. He did the good ones. but I was having dinner with him and a director whose name I cannot pronounce for the life of me. He's the director of the Brad Pitt movie, 7 Years in Tibet, which this director and Brad Pitt are banned from ever entering China because they did this pro-Tibet movie. At the next table, or a couple tables over, was Robert Downey Jr. and who's the guy that played Jim Morrison in the Doors movie? Val Kilmer.
Oh, okay.
And when they left, a bunch of people went and asked for their autograph. And when this director, whose name I can't even pronounce, and most Americans wouldn't have heard of him, when he left, he was f***ing mobbed. It was scary. It was like, I was right outside outside the window. He left before we did. And it was like, I've never been in a crush of people like that trying to be around somebody. I mean, he got mobbed like 5 times as much as Downey and Kilmer did.
Is that just because directors are valued more in that culture?
Okay. Yes.
I mean, I could see some directors in America getting more stuff like that than some celebrities. I mean, Steven Spielberg or something like that.
Yeah. But it's always been about the director in Europe. I mean, it wasn't in America back in the day. It was like the producers had the power and the studios had the power and the stars were manufacturing The directors were just, you know, project leaders.
Right.
I mean, there were a few, but the idea of the director as the auteur, the artist of the movie, is a French idea, you know?
Okay.
Yep. So, that's mine.
Okay, good deal. You want to talk about robots that kill people?
Well, I saw that a computer virus hit the U.S. drone fleet, and this was a tiny headline that barely made any news, and I'm like, what? What?
Yeah, I did notice that. Let's see. The virus, first detected nearly 2 weeks ago by the military's host-based security system, has not prevented flying their missions overseas. So apparently the virus didn't really do – I don't know what it was intended for, but I'm sure it must have been created to hopefully keep robots from killing people.
Which, you know, would be considered terrorism by the people that own the robots.
Unfortunately, yeah. We do live in bizarro world, and it would be considered terrorism to prevent the murder of civilians rather than promote it. But I did want to mention something else I had read on drones recently. I read an article basically about how, you know, this isn't a technology that America's going to have the monopoly on for very much longer. I mean, we were kind of first to market, for lack of a better word. Obviously, this has nothing to do with the market.
Well, wasn't that what they tried, what this guy that was probably set up, the Texan guy, wasn't it trying to get him to put bombs in model radio control
planes? No, that was a different, I think that was a different FBI operation to try to get some other guy to do that. I mean, there's been so many of them, I'm not sure if I'm confused on that, but I don't think that was the Iranian plot.
If Americans have the right to bear arms, when will they be selling drones at Walmart?
There you go, and that's another good question. But another question that this article I was reading raised was, I mean, what do we do when another nation or another group has a working drone fleet and starts to...
Well, we're not the only nation. We have sold them to a bunch of so-called friendly nations.
Right, right. But what do we do when a so-called unfriendly nation or an unpolitically
Iran's
connected...
Iran's got the drone.
Well, yeah. And we've already set the legal precedent that we can go into another country and kill people with these drones. So what happens when China kills somebody in Mexico? You know, what do we say then? We can't really say that that was wrong because we've done it. We don't really have that moral high ground to stand on. And, you know, what's China going to do when we criticize them for murdering a political dissident, you know, in any other country in the world?
Tibet.
Because that's basically what Al-Awlaki was. He was an American citizen. We didn't have any proof that he had done anything other than be critical of the United States in his videos.
Well, the answer to your question is it's going to turn into my drone can beat up your drone, and there will be an arms race with drones like there was with
And that's the really unfortunate thing.
I learned something that I didn't know recently was about the proliferation of tactical nukes from the 50s to like the 80s. And whenever you hear numbers of like the United States had 300,000 nukes or 30,000 nukes or whatever, they weren't all megaton nukes
right.
that could destroy.
Well, the difference
a state.
Between strategic nukes and tactical nukes, strategic nukes are the big ones that you would launch against a city, destroy a population center or, you know, a military production center. Tactical were smaller ones, supposedly for use on the battlefield against, you know, a phalanx of tanks or something like that.
Or to like basically in a way a dirty bomb, like to like pollute a county. Or less than a county, you know. But it blew me away seeing a picture of them. There was actually, it wasn't a shoulder-powered one, but it was something two men could carry, and the payload was, you know, like 50 pounds.
Huh. Okay.
You know, it was shot from what looked like a tripod-mounted mortar.
Okay.
And had a range of like 12 miles or something.
Right. And...
What, DJ?
They're tactical weapons.
Yeah, we just said that. Thanks, baby.
I seem to remember there was also some recent push to increase the arsenal of the United States tactical nukes instead of the strategic nukes. Is that what you're referring to as well, or are you just referring to hearing more about
stats? I didn't know
about
that, but actually, let me reiterate, they weren't really like a dirty bomb. What's so-called a dirty bomb is actually...
radioactive material on a conventional bomb that supposedly spreads it into the air. And
it's more a weapon of terror, of scaring people than of actually doing damage, because it really... wouldn't do anything like what a nuke would do, even a small nuke.
Right.
It might overwhelm one hospital, but it's not, it's more of something to scare.
It's more something the media does to scratch people's cat spots.
Yeah.
Also, another scratch cat spot nuke thing that people always mention is, you know, Iran could get one nuke and it would be disastrous to the whole world because they could blow it up in the atmosphere of the Eastern Seaboard and it'd be an EMP and we'd all go back to the Stone Age forever kind of thing, which obviously discounts any kind of market idea that, okay, all anybody would have to do is ship in new lines. You know, it'd take a few months and we could be back up and running. Or
So speaking of EMPs, electromagnetic pulses, you know, the one of the fallouts of a nuclear bomb is that it would temporarily shut down most or all communication systems with the electromagnetic pulse that goes along with it. And I think it's exaggerated on, we'd be back.
I really do.
We would not be back in the Stone Age forever. It would probably fry your computer memory and probably knock out your cell phone, but things would be up and running in a bit. But do you ever see the TV series Jericho? Did you ever watch that with me?
Me and you watched, you know, like the first six episodes of the first season, I think.
It's a good series. It starred Skeet Ulrich. And if you could find it anywhere, go watch it. It was canceled after 1.5 seasons. But the series starts with a nuke going off in Denver, and it ends with two guys raising a Don't Tread on Me flag. And there's a lot of good stuff in between. There's a lot of, like, citizens with guns using what they were intended for in the Second Amendment.
There's
the government is the enemy. There's, you know, the shadow government of this Blackwater-type organization that actually planted the bombs to take over the country. There's Wyoming becomes the new Washington, D.C. let's see, what else is in it? But there's one thing in it, like... the cars that still work after the nukes go off are all the older models that don't have all the computer chips in them.
There's a guy who writes a great blog named Eric Peterson, and it's an automotive blog, but he also writes libertarian blogs, you know, and a lot of it is auto-based, you know, basically talking about the ridiculousness of speed limits and, you know, the ridiculousness of, I think he's from Virginia, and you now have to go to court for reckless driving, and reckless driving is like any speed limit violation over something ridiculous like 15 miles per hour,
and you can't just... Can't just pay the ticket.
Yeah,
go to court with a judge or a judge and a jury.
I wasn't clear on that, but basically he talks a lot about the ridiculousness of our traffic laws and how they don't really make anybody safer. They're just, you know, a revenue stream for the bureaucrats and the parasite class. But he does write a lot about the kind of cars you would want in a end of the world situation, or that you want in general, so you can escape all the government mandates,
like pre-1985 Chevy trucks.
Yeah, things that wouldn't be destroyed by an EMP and things.
You know, like muscle cars, things you could fix easily. Probably not muscle cars because they use a lot of gas. But
well, one of his favorite era. His favorite advice, or one of his favorite cars that you should get that are, you know, you get for $3,000 is the original VW Bug, or whatever the first generation is of the VW Bug.
Just some of those are still around, man, from the 60s, and they're air cooled.
Air cooled, exactly.
I can't even get into the engine on our car. You know, I open it up, it's like I can't get to the carburetor. You need tools that are only made for that brand, that only there's a monopoly on them, only the service people have them. Like my old Plymouth Barracuda, I could open it up with a wrench and a screwdriver and fix things in it, and I'm not a car guy, but I learned to be. You have to be if you have a 1966 Plymouth Barracuda.
Right, and it's also important to note that we don't really have a free market when it comes to automobiles anymore, and we haven't for some time. A lot of the things that are in modern cars are government mandated.
And will be more so.
Will be more so. And the other thing is licensing, and basically to have a car right now, you have to spend millions or hundreds of thousands or some ginormous amount to go through all the government testing. You know, when they show you that video of smashing cars, you have to be able to basically afford to smash up 50 of your cars if you're going to go to market with something. You know, you can't be, you know, Mr. Backyard Genius Mechanic and build a product that's better than anybody else's that people are going to want to buy, because you're not going to have the money to do that.
Where in LibPair, it would be done the way it used to be done, where you'd get Car and Driver magazine or you'd get Consumer Reports and it would tell you.
Right, exactly. You smash up one car, or you don't smash up any cars, and people understand that that's a risk when they buy your car. You know, and you have something, you know, a statement like people like IKEA says, you know, we wanted to save you money, so we don't have service people. It's self-help. You could do that with your car. You could say, we wanted to save you money, so we didn't test our cars.
So the car drive is going to come. Risk. So my car is going to come in a big crate as parts with an Allen key.
That could work in LibPair, you know, and it'd be up to the consumer. And if that wasn't a model that people wanted to drive, or that wasn't something that people were going for, then nobody would buy it and it would cease to exist, and that supposed danger wouldn't be around for people. But if you're, you know, 16 and you're an orphan and you've been working your low-paying job and you need a vehicle, by all means, go buy the dangerous car, or quote-unquote dangerous car, drive it for a year or two until you get more money, and then upgrade.
You know, a couple weeks ago, we were talking about putting together furniture from Target.
Yeah.
And you said you got frustrated and gave up and took yours back. I think part of the reason we succeeded with ours was, while it says in the instructions all you need is the enclosed Allen key and a Phillips head screwdriver, we used a bunch more tools and it really helped. You know, we used a drill. We used a drill with a screwdriver bit on it. We had rubber hammers and a bunch of stuff that I don't know if you guys had that made it really work. I think I would have given it up if I just...
Well, I'm down for that. And, you know, it's not like we're technically unsavvy. I've built a million IKEA pieces of furniture and love them to death. I love the IKEA model. I think the thing with our Target piece of furniture was we had made one mistake. You know, and the thing with Target is it's a lot... In that particular product, it was a lot harder to correct a mistake, you know, because there was glue involved.
Yeah.
So once we had glued the wooden peg in place and it was the wrong place, we couldn't fix it.
They didn't include enough glue. I had some glue.
Right.
So that was another thing.
See, with IKEA, there was no glue involved. If you put the wooden peg in the wrong hole, you just pull it out and put it in the right one.
Yep. More things should work like IKEA.
Yeah. Yeah, they really should.
Those socialists come up with a good idea now and then, but they don't do it through the government. IKEA was not founded or mandated by the government.
Right. So, yeah, I do dig IKEA, but I don't necessarily dig the Swedish government model.
So, did you see the thing about feds trying to outlaw satire? There's a House bill.
They wish they could.
There's a House bill for continued funding for the TSA that includes some little weasel language in the middle of a whole bunch of other stuff that would make it a crime to impersonate being a TSA member in any way, in any media, including teleplays through computer networks, which is the internet, etc. With no allocation for parody, which is proven time and time again by the courts to be, you know, for what courts are worth, to be part of the what the First Amendment includes is parody.
So yeah, that would never, you know, I hope that would never stand up.
Oh, but it will, man. It's going to pass because it's in the middle of this other bill that they're going to crazy cat spot through. But you know, it's going to make it so, like, if I go, on the podcast, I'm a TSA guy, I'm really stupid and like to feel people's junk, that could be a crime soon.
Yeah, and I guess the sad thing is, like we saw with the Wyoming Firearms Freedom Act, you know, it was a great bill, basically had teeth for, you know, putting federal agents in jail or fining them if they infringe on people's Second Amendment rights, but nobody wants to be the first one to test it in court. Nobody wants to actually do that and have to litigate it.
And our governor ran on supporting that act. You asked him to his face on camera and he said it, but
yep.
He's a U.S. attorney. You know, former U.S. attorney.
Yeah, really he was a federal attorney. You think he'd throw his old buddies in jail? Yeah,
that's what a U.S. attorney is a federal attorney.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that's obviously ridiculous. And I guess that's the sad thing is, on its face, this is no law because it's unjust law and it's an obviously unconstitutional law. But, you know, somebody might get arrested for that. Somebody might have their podcast or their TSA video where they're making fun of the TSA and they could be penalized for it and have to end up going to court and spending years and thousands of dollars in legal costs.
You know, I think I somehow in the back of the lizard part of my freedom brain, I saw this coming because we made some really clear decisions in the Guns and Weed movie, or I made some clear decisions to not call things by the real name. Like, Dan Banning isn't a cop from agency XYZ. He's a drug cop. We just call him a drug cop.
Right.
Things like that. Like, I thought for a minute of calling him that other, you know, three-letter thing that's the drug thing. But no, it was just, he's a drug cop.
Yeah.
But he's obviously federal because he's busting people in San Francisco and in Wyoming. Or Wyoming. Montana?
I think it was Montana. Yeah, that's where the bear...
the bear has eaten him.
Yeah.
Simply had good taste. Yeah.
Yes. If you want to know what we're talking about, go ahead and pre-order Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom.
Now that I have a 60-second ad for the movie, I should just put it in every 5 minutes.
Since time began, tyrants have taken aim at personal liberties. Now there's a movie that aims back.
The government has no more right to tell us what to put in our bodies than they have to take our guns or tell us what books we can read.
Six drug police were eaten by bears while raiding a marijuana farm.
On your knees, you dirty hippies! Jesus. On your knees!
What's the problem, officer?
Today, many cops who enforce pot laws do so only because it provides them with cushy jobs, good benefits, and a chance to push people around.
I was an undercover narcotics officer. The drug war is nothing but a farce.
The Second Amendment says you gotta keep you and your gat intact.
Guns and Weed, The Road to Freedom. A film by Michael W. Dean and Nima Vadadi.
DVD ships by or before December 6th. Available for pre-order at gunsandweed.com or on Amazon. Makes the perfect holiday gift. Remember, that's gunsandweed.com.
Yeah, Ian from Free Talk Live asked me, I had a 2.5 minute ad, and he asked me to make one that was 59.65 seconds, which is a radio requirement for their automated system of just putting ads in whenever there's a space.
Yes.
I made it like 59.65 seconds, like to the thousandth of a second. It was pretty fun and a good challenge.
Nice. But that's a good thing to bring up. You know, they are playing our ads on Liberty Radio Network. We've increased our relationship with them.
And on Free Talk Live.
So thank you so much. I'd just like to say we'd like to extend our deepest gratitude to the folks over there at Free Talk Live and
yep.
Ian and Mark and
Liberty Radio Network.
LRN.FM.
I think we all need to stick together. You know, we're not in competition with other Liberty folks.
Someone asked me the other day, they posted this video on Facebook of Adam and the Man talking about
Adam versus the Man.
Adam versus the Man. Right. Adam and the Man. Adam versus the Man, of him talking about the, you know, all laws are enforced with a gun to the head theory. And someone said, you know, I don't know if you know about this guy, but this sounds like he's in competition with you, which must be someone who's really new to liberty. They must have thought we came up with that theory, which is like libertarian 101. I don't even know who came up with it. Do you? It's old,
but I guess the person who I feel like said it most succinctly, and he probably...
Shane Sheed
did it great, on a personal level. I think also Stefan Molyneux has a really great bit about showing people the gun in the room, and how he had this whole monologue about how, you know, he used to go up and bring up stats and say, well, see, freedom works because, you know, when you have a government, they end up doing this and this, and you have this much less revenue, and then, you know, the money supply goes blah, blah, blah. And he said, you know, that's all gravy. It's gravy that freedom actually works. What you really got to point out is the morality of it. And if you could say that, isn't it wrong to point guns at people and threaten to shoot them if they don't do what you want them to do? And if somebody says, of course that's wrong, then you have that starting point. You say, okay, well, that's what the government does. Now, don't you see why they're wrong?
He's brilliant. And I'm honored to be, you know, he's one of the syndicated feeds on LRN along with us. And so is Anti-War Radio and Lou Rockwell. So we're in good company there. But, you know, he's great. And I really respect him. And he's a self-taught libertarian economist who, you know, was a software engineer 10 years ago. That was what he was trained to do.
Well, I believe he calls himself a philosopher, and I really buy that. He's not just economy. I mean, it's mostly about the philosophical roots of why freedom is the most beneficial and the most moral point of view.
He's hardcore in a way. He'd say we're theorists. He'd say I'm a theorist because I'm going to go vote. I'm going to vote for Ron Paul, but I'm only voting for Ron Paul to like register my popularity contest in it, you know? And I'd say he's a theorist because he talks about the gun in the room, but he can't show a gun in his video because he lives in Canada. He should come marry some American woman and live in Montana if he really wants to be free. Just go over the border.
Well, I think he's fighting the good fight, and that's the other thing about...
I'm kidding about that. But anyway, what I was going to say was this guy asked me to bring this full circle. This guy said, you know, it sounds like this Adam guy is in competition with you guys. And I just immediately knew the answer. I mean, it was like I didn't even have to think about it. I said, I don't think there's competition in Liberty Media. I think
we're on the same side.
It's all the same side.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. And we're not trying to... We shouldn't infight, you know? We all want the same thing.
But we would like more listeners. So everyone go to the updated... There's a couple things on the website that I've updated that I want to crow about. Hey, did you know that the reason a crowbar is called a crowbar is because it enables you to do feats of amplified strength that you can crow about or brag about? It's true.
Well, I never heard the term crow used as a verb for bragging, so...
That's because you're under 60, not like me. Nah, because you're, you know, I'm 47. I'm old. So, let's see, what did we do? I added a new thing on the website. It's on a page that already existed. There's a link at the top to...
Promote the fiends.
Promote the fiends.
Yeah.
Yep. There's a new thing at the top of that page, if you go to that page, where there are downloadable, printable PDF flyers and handbills for Freedom Fiends. Someone asked me for this. The guy's name, I will shout out to him because he got me to do this. I hadn't considered this. Guy named Ian Wilson wanted to hand him out at his college, and a protest he was going to.
Awesome.
He's hanging the flyers up at his college, and then there's two up, you know, two per page. You cut the page in half after you print it. Handbills, he's handing them out at the Occupy Boston thing.
Yes. And much love to Ian Wilson. He's a big fan of ours. He sends us links on our Facebook about things we should look into and possibly cast on. He's a great guy. He's definitely a fiend, and we dig it because we love to serve the fiends.
And these fiend flyers and handbills will print color or black and white well. I added a new link for streaming audio, if you like old school style streaming audio or new school, whatever you want to call it. I added a page called Podcast Player. The Podcast Player used to be over on the side of the page, but it was screwing up the loading, having it on every page. It was conflicting because it's Flash. It was conflicting with the embedded Flash of all the YouTube videos. So I moved it to its own page. And
okay.
That's it.
And speaking of the Occupy movements, I think it's really important to have something like Freedom Media being passed out to those folks.
Because they only see half the picture. Well, a lot of them.
It's very disjointed, and, you know, people tell me, oh, well, what's the point? And I think there is a point to it.
There is a point.
I don't want to rag on them. These are people that feel very disenchanted, and they know something's wrong. I don't see that as, you know, oh, these people are just wasting their time. I think it's an opportunity. This is almost the moment that we as Liberty people have been waiting for. This is a moment to get in there. We're supposed to win the intellectual battle. We're supposed to be educating people.
This is our Arab Spring. How did the Arab Spring start? It was with one guy. What was it? What was the first shot?
It was a guy in Tunisia. A lot of people say that this is sort of the origin. A guy in Tunisia was trying to sell his fruit at a fruit stand. He didn't have the proper government forms because everything was very bureaucratized there, or very bureaucratic. And so the cops or whoever the enforcers there were hassling him for it. He wasn't able to feed his family. Young guy, I think he was my age, had a college degree or had some type of education, but couldn't find work in his field. So he had to sell fruit on the side of the street. And these guys wouldn't even let him do it, you know, because the economy was so shot from all the statist intervention. There was no economy, had to sell fruit on the street. Cops busted him. He tried to go get the permits then after the cops busted him, just gave him the fourth degree. He could never get the thing working and was just being harassed. And so he said, F it. Obviously, we don't condone this kind of thing, but he went and, you know, burned himself up in front of the city hall or whatever it was.
Committed there. Suicide by burning himself.
Right. Self-immolated or whatever the word is. Yes. And that's sort of what sparked it. You know, then there was big protests and a big movement, and the government ended up getting thrown. And then, of course, it spread to Egypt and now Syria and this whole thing. But I don't necessarily see this. I mean, because again, with the Arab Spring, there hasn't really been that educational moment. You know, everybody is very upset, but what they think they want is democracy and the people to get a choice and pick the right rulers or the right slave master. I think what we need to be doing now that there's this Occupy movement in America is show people what's really wrong, because a lot of the movement is saying, you know, it's all about corporate greed and we want to tax the corporations. We want to bring them down to our level of serfdom. When the other right direction to go in is to, how about break us all out of the serfdom? How about we get rid of the king instead of trying to have the king enforce more rules on his court or his nobles?
People always want to try to reform government or streamline it, or when a cop kills somebody, they're like, we want a rigorous investigation. But Ron Paul said it the other day, you know, at the debates, he's like, something like, let me be clear, I don't want to reform or streamline the U.S. tax code or change it or make it more fair. I want to eliminate it.
Yes.
I want to eliminate federal income tax completely.
Yeah, exactly. And people get scared of that because they have never been taught an alternative at all. And this is our opportunity. I mean, yeah, pass out the Freedom Fiends bills, pass out Liberty Radio stuff, pass out any kind of freedom things like that, and do it on register. Just have conversations with people. You're really intellectual people. Hand them a copy of Butler Schaefer's Boundaries of Order, or what I'm saying is you should do it on register. I mean, some people like to read a long philosophical book. Some people like to get a pamphlet. Do it based on your conversation with the person, or direct them to a certain thing. If people are blog readers, direct them to a Liberty blog you love. If people are podcast listeners, direct them to us or Free Talk Live.
If you're a hot chick, dress slutty and hand out handbills for Freedom Media to guys who aren't with a girl.
Right, and just be able to explain to people in a rational way that getting rid of government doesn't mean that you'll have no rule of law or no natural law. All it means is you won't have a top-down situation where somebody is forcing you to do something by violence.
Worms.
It's as simple as that, and do it in whatever way. I mean, I'm not saying do one way and everybody should be passing out this one book. I'm saying do whatever way you think will work for whoever you're talking to.
I'll say it. Everyone should hand out Freedom Fiends flyers. Freedom Fiends flyers. I didn't sleep enough.
Well, the do name that too. I mean, you've said it before. We're really accessible. You know, we're kind of the training wheels, I hope, for Liberty.
Yes. So you know what the name of this episode is?
No, and I still won't know once you tell me, because you're going to change it.
It's called Drinking Coffee in the Middle of the Night.
All right.
Which really has nothing to do with freedom, but it kind of speaks to where I get a lot of my ideas. You know, like, I was up at 4:30 this morning. I was kind of tired. I'm like, okay, I'm going to drink coffee. And then I didn't go to bed until about 5 p.m., and I got up at 7 p.m. So, yeah, you know, fighting freedom with the fiends is a hard job, and it takes a lot. And it, also, I really want to stress, people should go review us on iTunes and rate us on iTunes. And if you can make a donation, make a donation. It helps, because this is a part-time job for me. It's a very part-time job for Nima. You know, it's more than just the recording. We talk throughout the week and plan stuff.
And right. And we would like to expand it. Now that
I interrupt your dates with your wife, you know.
Well, also, now that I am free of the shackles of mainstream media, you know, if we have that demand, I can start expanding my media work more into this realm, you know, and maybe do video updates or whatever that may be.
We were discussing what kind of laptop you need to buy to do good editing.
Right. And, you know, I've got a great skill set for putting media together, and I've been using all my powers for statism, and I am so done with that. And
you owe the world. You have to make amends now.
I do. And Guns and Weed was a good start, but
you don't owe the world shit, but yeah, you know, I kind of joke that a lot of what I do is making amends for the fact that I voted for Bill Clinton and Feinstein.
Well, I feel I owe it to myself to cleanse my palate of the statism and start doing productive work for freedom.
We're anarcho-capitalists. We don't owe anybody anything. And if you listen to one more second of Freedom Fiends without making a donation, you're stealing. I'm kidding.
Obviously, Michael.
So let's on that joke. But do make a donation if you'd like. On that joke, I think we could tie this up in a knot and.
All right. Peace out, fiends.
Peace, worms.
Are you one of the 12% of Americans who still approves of our government? Then we need your help to force the other 88% into compliance. Our democracy depends on it. We're an organization called Citizens Against Too Much Unfettered Freedom, or CATMUF. CATMUF is a bipartisan political action committee whose goal is expanding government until nothing else remains. Because the government is here to help you. How can you help CATMUF help you? Through horizontal enforcement. Horizontal enforcement is how concerned citizens help grow government with our day-to-day attitudes and actions. Because no matter how much government expands, there can't always be a police officer or federal agent everywhere. That's where you come in. Start snitching. If you see something, even if it's nothing, say something. When you're not busy spying on your neighbors or squinting at everyone, spout an endless stream of verbal horizontal enforcement. Tell anyone who will listen, and especially those who don't want to listen, why more government is a good thing. Do this constantly. You'll get a warm and fuzzy feeling demanding more taxes, arguing in favor of gun control while militarizing our police, and shaming anyone who's caught breaking any law or criticizing our justice system. Who needs innocent until proven guilty? If someone gets arrested, they're probably guilty. So act like they are until they are. Here at CATMUF, we don't care if you vote Democrat or Republican, as long as you vote for candidates committed to growing our federal family. Because more government means more warm, fuzzy feelings for all of us. CATMUF. Because folks just aren't smart enough to handle real freedom.
CATMUF is not a real political action committee. It's a fiction created for satirical expression protected by the First Amendment, which may still exist in some form despite the so-called Patriot Act. This ad was actually produced by the good people at the Freedom Fiends podcast. That's FreedomFeens.com.
Hello, Freedom Fiends. It's your boy Dean from the U.S. Get the U.S. out my bloodstream.
The Freedom Fiends podcast is covered by a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license. Do what you want with it and spread it around. Tell two friends. Make copies. Email it to everyone you know. Go on the site and comment. This is a conversation. Every Friday night, we'll have an exciting new episode where Michael W. Dean and Nima Vadadi weave their own unique take on the way the world works and how to find your place in it. Available from freedomfiends.com. That's FreedomFeens.com. Subscribe and tell two friends.
And remember, the only power they have is the power you allow them.